During the mid-90s, a cultural revolution hit Britain, which had the power to shake the very foundations of popular culture. Suddenly, teenagers were awakening from the social depression of the 80s to find a brand new sound of soft rock. For 5 years in the 90s, Britpop ruled the world and created melancholic music which defined a generation. In this series, to celebrate 30 years of Britpop, Josh and the team speak to some of the key players who were pivotal to the most potent musical movement since the Beatles and ask what made this period so culturally significant. So don't look back in anger, girls and boys, let's go for gold as we remember the cultural phenomenon that was Britpop.
Writer, producer and broadcaster Matt Everett shot to fame in the mid-90s when he replaced Todd Parmenter as drummer of the Britpop group Menswear, whose hits include the 1995 indie classics Daydreamer and Sleeping In, which came to define the social liberation of the time. After leaving Menswear in 1996, Everett later joined the Montrose Avenue. By the dawn of the new millennium, the Britpop phenomenon was over, and in 2002, for the first time in over 30 years, the BBC launched a brand new radio station which saw Matt turn his hand to broadcasting. In 2017, he launched the BBC podcast The First Time, where some of the most famous and influential musicians in the world talked to him about the seminal first moments that changed their lives and careers. As part of Beyond the Title's Britpop season, I caught up with the soft rock icon to talk dreams, sounds, and his memories of the period that came to define modern pop culture. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Matt Everett.
Throughout history, after a big economic downturn, there's always been a sense of cultural renaissance that has been the driving force for change. What do you think it was about the 80s which compelled so many teenagers to pick up their guitars?
That's a good question, isn't it? That is a good question. I think when... life's about choice, isn't it? Life is about choice. It's about having choices. That's what everybody wants. And the harder life is and the more tough things are, the less choices you have. It forces you down one route that maybe you don't want to go down. And I think when times are really tough, people financially or in terms of social mobility don't have those choices. So they get stuck in one thing. Whereas creativity is yours. You can do that on your own. It doesn't matter if you're, within reason, you know, you can write. You don't need to have a wealthy parent to be able to write something brilliant. You know, you might need it if you want to work in banking or, you know, so I think that sometimes the limitations force creativity. Just be, you know, maybe scrabbling enough together to get a crappy guitar and just having that's yours. You own that. It doesn't matter what else is happening in the world. You can express yourself in that way. So I think hardship, I think it was, I don't know, Billy Bragg that said like the only good thing that Thatcher did was just, you know, inspire people to make music saying how much they hated her. And there's something about that. Defiance is good sometimes, you know. I think bands make their best music often when their backs are against the wall, when they haven't got, like, there's loads of records like, oh, you're going to get dropped unless this next album does well, or like, you know, you've hit some problem. And it not always, because, you know, adversity's not always the most enjoyable experience, but it can result in good art and creativity, because it's you, isn't it? You're trying to do something. And I think that's, you can feel that in certain decades. So maybe that's it.
Listening to Britpop all these years later, there are very strong themes of escaping to better things, savouring the good times and making the best of what we've got. What do you think it was about Britain's socio-economic structure of the 80s which made the lower middle classes more passionate to take control of their own destiny?
Man, that's a good question. That's what everyone said. You're good at this. It's really because I remember sort of being in that point in the early 90s. Something that gets talked a lot about with Britpop is I was a reaction to America. It was like something, once again, that you know, we'd had Nirvana and we'd had all those bands and Soundgarden and Tad and Mudhoney, and it was like Pearl Jam, and it was, oh, this felt like ours. So that was a little bit of it. But it felt simultaneously nostalgic and also forward thinking. There's this weird thing where, like, everybody was listening to the Kinks, everybody was listening to Wire, everybody was listening to sort of like I mean, in my little circle as well, we sort of overlapped a bit with pulp and people like that. There was this sort of like, oh, the sort of strange French Euro pop from the 60s and that whole sort of slightly, you know, Mondo Biondo weird lounge pop stuff. So it felt like harking back to that was, because it felt like a more creative time. It felt a lot more nuanced and strange than a lot of the American stuff, which is great. In terms of middle classes, I don't know. I mean, I come from essentially a middle class family, so I was able to go. I came from a middle class family in Birmingham, and I moved to London to go to art school because it was like, well, that's what you do if you want to form a band, which was the thing. That was the 60s thing, wasn't it? That was Pete Townsend, John Lennon, you know, Ray Davies is what you did. You went to art school to form a band. So that's why I did it. So I guess I was brought up, thanks to my parents, with this idea of, oh, you can go to university. My mum was the first person in her family to go to university. So it was my dad. So we were kind of told, like, oh, this is a thing you can do. So like I was brought up on that idea of this is a route. And with that comes this idea of, if you've had choice, comes back to choice again, if my parents' generation had the choice not just to basically go from school to work to family, if they had that choice for the first time, you know, especially in the Midlands, it wasn't really like, oh, I'm going to go to university. No, you're not. You live in Coventry. You're going to go and work in a factory. That also followed through to like, well, what do you want to do? You could be a writer. You could be a musician. You could be a playwright. You could be an artist or a sculptor. Not saying that's any more valid than any other role, but those were options that felt open to me as a middle-class person with my background. So first of all, being an art student was like, although my dad was like, what? You've got to study a proper subject. And then a couple of years later, yeah, I'm going to be a drummer. Like that went down really, really fucking well. Actually, fairness to him, he came around pretty quickly. But that was all through knowing it was a possibility and kind of being told by my parents, yeah, like you can do that. That's an option. You don't have to just earn a living with the immediate thing that your parents have done or the immediate thing on your doorstep. So that's not exclusively a middle-class luxury. But it does help if you've got a certain amount of an environment where you maybe had a bit more disposable income and your parents had opportunities. So maybe that does make it a thing. And there was, you know, I mean, Oasis blew that out of the water by being permanently working class, exactly, and just going like, fuck this shit, we're getting out of here, which is a whole different motivator. Blur, Oasis, we're there already. The two different, the middle class and the working class. But for me, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it. Choices.
It's funny you should mention the Kinks, because I remember seeing Ray Davies on Don't Forget Your Toothbrush.
I remember that show. That was a nuts show, wasn't it? Yeah. He's very, like, I did a Kinks event not that long ago. That's the other thing. I apologize for some of the terrible name dropping I will do. I love my job. I do love speaking to musicians and I do like telling stories about musicians. So I apologize for the name drops. We did like, there was a Kinks event a while ago and the three remaining members were all in the room at the same time. And I was like, wow, this is like, are they going to talk to, and they're like, they wouldn't talk to each other. like there was an audience there and they had a little stage performance of this play, but none of them, even after all this time, you're like, guys, come on, like you're getting on it. Just shake hands and get on with it. But they wouldn't. There was no contact. They sat in different parts of the theatre. You're like, fucking hell, guys, come on, you're the Kinks.
Come on. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like, come on. Anyway, I digress.
It's okay. You love an anecdote, don't you? You love name. Oh, yeah. It's good content. You joined the band Menswear in the mid-90s as the second drummer. How difficult was it to join an already established group, and how do you think this changed the dynamic and sound of Menswear? In your opinion, how important is a drummer to a band?
Oh, I mean, that's two big questions. Well, actually, one me question and one bigger question. I mean, with Menswear, the drummer was a nice guy, but they all knew that he wasn't great. I mean, I'm not fucking Dave Grohl by any stretch of the imagination. Certainly wasn't when I was 18. But they kind of knew that they needed somebody else. Because you got, like, when I went to the very first rehearsal, they got rid of the drummer. I went to the very first rehearsal of Menswear. And bear in mind, like, so I'm 18, 19, and all I'd ever wanted to do really was be the drummer in a band and get signed. That was the big thing. It matters less these days, but like to get signed to a record label was a big deal. And that meant like, oh, you'd kind of made it. And I'd never been in a band that got anywhere close to being signed or even had any interest from any record label. I'm going to the first rehearsal at Menswear and the bass player driving me back to the tube station saying, oh, you know, we're going to get signed, don't you? Like very soon. I was like, what? I'd literally played, they had three songs. Not even that. And he was like, yeah, we're going to get signed. They were so confident that it was going to happen. And they were absolutely right. We did one gig and there was like five record companies there. We had six songs and they wanted to sign us to like £500,000 record deal, which is pretty stupid if you think about it. Don't give that much money to a bunch of kids that young with that little experience. So yeah, it's, I mean, in terms of the difference the drummer makes, it makes all the difference. I mean, I'm biased. You know, on stage, a band can, like the guitarist can have a bad night and the bass player can have a bad night. You know, let's say the singer, but generally, like, but if the drummer has a bad night, everyone knows about it because it's the bedrock of the whole thing. I mean, I'm biased. It keeps everything together. It's the foundation of everything that goes on top. Like, if a guitarist plays a wrong note, it might be a bit awkward. If a drummer drops a stick and the song stops, the song will stop. Because if the drummer stops, 9 times out of 10, the song stops. And the personality of great drummers is so woven into the personality of the band. You know, like, the Beatles wouldn't sound like the Beatles if it wasn't for Ringo. They just wouldn't. They wouldn't sound the same. They would not be as good. And I think you can say that for nearly all great bands. There's something, and it's nothing to do with speed or necessarily technical ability. It's got to do with personality and empathy and character and taste and understanding. Because everybody plays differently. You could play exactly the same thing. Another name drop. Let's give you another name drop story. It's not about drums. So, like, anyone could play the same thing, but exactly the same beat, the same rhythm, the same speed. And a different person doing it will sound completely different, even though it's the same thing. We did this thing, me and Sean Keeney, who I used to do a thing on Six Music with, went to David Gilmour house. David Gilmour from Pink Floyd was selling all these guitars. And he had this black Stratocaster. It's like the most famous guitar played on all the Pink Floyd stuff. And we were like, why are we treating this thing like a hallowed object? This is like, wow, this is the guitar that's done, you know, Dark Side of the Moon. This is his guitar. And it sounds, you know, when he plays, it just sounds like David Gilmour. And we were going like, wow, you know, you're auctioning in this for charity. It's a pretty cool thing to do. And he just said, but it's just a guitar. If someone else picks it up, it'll sound like them. I can pick up another guitar and it'll sound like me. It doesn't really matter. We're like, no, don't say that. This is a hallowed thing. And he's right. And it's all to do the tiniest nuances with how you as a person play faster or slower, or the mood you're in, or how you hold it, or just that every tiny little increment of how you play your instrument means you play it completely different to anyone else. And so, yeah, a drummer is paramount. But as I say, I'm biased because I'm a drummer.
I always find it a strange concept to talk about the indie anthems because, by its very definition, indie music is better when it's not commercially marketed. But your 1995 hit Daydreamer has become a Britpop anthem. Is this pop elsewhere we're trying to achieve, or did commercial success actually kill the concept of Britpop as you knew it?
Good question again. I mean, it's difficult because everybody, I mean, a lot of us were really young. A lot of us were like, you know, barely out of our teens. I think our guitarist was 16 when we got signed. You don't know anything when you're 16. You haven't got like the critical thought to go, well, okay, what's the best move? How do I get, is this what I want? If I want to make a great record, then how do I get there? And who are the people I need around me and all that? You don't think, you just think, great, there's a free bar. Awesome. there's very little strategic thinking going on. So we weren't really thinking about what was best, what was the best thing to do, and how the impact of signing to a major label and being part of that commercial machine would impact on the music. We just thought, great, someone's going to fly us to New York. A lot of the bands that have been around a bit longer, especially Pulp and Blur, had some experience under their belt, and they were able to think more about what they wanted to achieve and how best to do that. You know, it's not a coincidence that Radiohead very clearly didn't have anything to do with Britpop, partially stylistically, but also, like, as they said themselves, like, we lived in Oxford. We didn't move to Camden. We wanted to stay there and do our own thing. You know, they were thinking about how best to do the work they wanted to do and express themselves without being part of that melee of gossip and money and stuff. So did it damage us? Yeah, I think there was a point, had we signed to a smaller label and been allowed to develop and learnt some stuff and had the corners knocked off us, we would have acted less like dickheads and we would have had a better, longer career. That is true. At one point, we were being chased by a bunch of record labels, and we were being chased by London Records and Warner Brothers, but also by Rough Trade. If you know Rough Trade, like, amazing label, you know, the Smiths, you know, and then later the Strokes, like, amazing, incredible indie label. They're probably Britain's greatest indie label. And we were being courted by all the big labels. They flew us out to America and took us for these massive dinners and had all these huge lavish parties, and we had limos and stuff before we'd released a single thing. And Jeff Travis, the head of Rough Trade, was like, oh, I'm in New York when you're over there. Let's go for a meeting. Let's talk. I still want to sign you. I remember he took us to, like, just this little pizza place in Manhattan, scruffy little pizza joint. And we had this meeting, and then, you know, we split the bill at the end of it. And we all remember walking away thinking, like, he didn't even pick up the bill for the pizza. Like, what a tosser. We're not going to go with it. We're like, also, like, just pizza place. We've been going to, like, amazing parties. And then with hindsight, you're like, yeah, the person that, because you all spent, like, all those parties and monies, we paid for it eventually. When we got signed, that wasn't free. We paid for it. The person we should have gone for, but the person going, let's split the cost of the cheap pizzas. We don't need a big posh party. Let's just talk about, you know, doing some work together. That's the person we should assign with, because clearly that's the smart move. But when you're 19, you're thinking, "Hey, I'm in New York. This is great." So, yeah, I think had we signed with him, it would have been different. I don't know if we would have gone on to have been like a world changing band, but we would have done better work because of it, I think, you know, or not. Who knows?
Well.
Yeah, but also that era had to start at some point.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. If you take away the idiocy and the fun, the kind of handbrake comes off hurtling towards who knows what, then the music would have been very different for a lot of bands. I don't think, you know, some of that, the propulsion in a lot of that music, the kind of giddy sense of excitement and anything is possible and fuck it, we're doing it. That, if you take that away, if the music becomes smarter, it loses some of its appeal. The best of music of that era is kind of overlaps on those things, that it's kind of celebratory, but it's also, you know, it's got a reason to exist, and it's got some form and some thought to it. That wasn't necessarily us very much, but yeah. That's the spirit of it, I guess, a lot of it.
What are your memories of appearing on TFI Friday?
I've got lots of memories of being, I mean, I love TFI Friday. I was on it a few times with Menswear, and then I was on it with a band called Montrose Avenue that I was in after Menswear. Much better band. Sold about 20 records. I remember the bar upstairs at TFI Friday used to be a real functioning bar. So you could go in and everybody would be drinking on a live TV show. Not necessarily a very good idea, but everyone loved that. They had to stop it eventually because people were just getting shit-faced.
Yeah.
Although I do remember after they stopped making it a real bar that you could serve, so it was dry. You went upstairs after your performance and there was just everyone standing around. I remember seeing Richard Madeley from Richard and Judy standing at the end of the bar with a pint. And I remember going, how come you've got a drink? You're the only one here that's got a pint. And he said, like, there's some advantages to being Richard Madeley. And I thought, that's quite cool.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Chris Evans working everybody really, really hard. I think it was one of the first times I'd seen, like, inside a big live TV show. And him being completely in control. He was like a pilot. Pretty full on to his staff. Like, that camera's in the wrong place. That's not good enough. Move that stuff. I mean, he worked everybody really hard. But him being completely in control of the entire show. It was a complex show, like four, five light bands. Biggest guests in the world at that time. And I remember him being tough, a tough boss, but then at the end of it, taking everybody to the pub and being really grateful for everybody's work and really kind of, you know, putting people through the ringer, but being very appreciative of their work at the end of it. I remember meeting Betty Boo. The 15-year-old me was very happy about that. I remember watching Garbage and thinking they're really fucking good. They're better than us. I remember Black Grape. I think we hung out with Black Grape and then them going on and Sean Ryder swearing on live telly and thinking, what? Oh, you knew that was going to happen. What did you think was going to happen? Put Sean Ryder on a live TV show. Like, come on.
When you look back at it now, you just think, what were they thinking? No good idea. Were any of these good ideas?
But yeah, it was an amazingly ambitious show to do. I know that sort of that Chris Emmons' idea was to kind of ape that sort of Friday Night Live, that American like full live show, big band thing. But even Friday Night Live didn't have three live bands. And I mean, he gave a break to a lot of people, you know, like there was a lot of bands that never would have got on that first rung of the ladder had he not decided to put them on live TV, relatively untested, you know. So that was pretty great. That freedom's gone. I mean, obviously everything's changed. We don't watch TV like we used to and blah, blah, blah. But that destination television, you know, before you went out or whatever, you'd watch that TV show and it captured the moment of that week, whatever everybody was talking about, be captured in that show or something would happen that everybody would then talk about. It really set the agenda. It's an incredible achievement for him as for Chris Evans as a producer and a broadcaster. Now, I mean, you know, he's some people, he got on their nerves a lot, but you can't argue with the impact he was having. Yeah. Brilliant. It was a really good fun show.
There's a famous quote, I think, said by John Lennon that when asked about Ringo Starr's talents as a drummer, he said, Ringo wasn't even the best drummer.
Oh, now.
In your opinion, to what extent is the role of the drummer taken for granted within the dynamics of a band?
I mean, the Ringo thing. Oh, don't get me fucking started. I could go on for fucking days about Ringo. I really, really, really could.
So we move on.
The role of the drummer is enormously underappreciated because I don't think people, if you say you're a Foo Fighters fan and then someone re-recorded those tracks with a different drummer, you'd be like, what the fuck is this? Like it's so woven into the song and part of the character of the song that you almost don't know that you know that it's part of the song. Ringo, I don't think John really said that. John, as if I knew him. John. I think John Lennon really said that. I think it's one of those stories that people like to sort of say, because he was phenomenal. He was incredible. There's a lovely sort of YouTube clip. I think it was when Ringo was getting a Grammy Award for something, Lifetime Achievement. And they've got this little video. I'll send you the link. It's good. So all these other incredible drummers all doing a little interview to camera, sitting behind Ringo's kit, saying why he's like the best, the absolute best. And there's all these phenomenally gifted players. And Dave Grohl comes on and he plays a bit of Come Together, you know, dum, 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 and he goes, you know that. You know that riff. That's a drum riff. And you know it. He came up with that. And the verse of that chorus is just dum, 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 dum. And everyone like, oh yeah, he says, if you can do that, dum, 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 just play that and get people dancing, you're a badass. And he's right. It's not about like, oh wow, she can play a million notes at a second, or like, well, it's not. It's about groove and soul and personality. So yeah, but that's the drummer's lot. We sit at the back, you know, we just get on with it. People don't appreciate how amazing we are. That's fine, you know, but they miss us when we're not there.
Yeah. You might think
the one that you watched. What did you make of the Beatles documentary? It's on Disney Plus. Have you seen
it? Oh, Get Back. Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I think I've watched it twice now, and I'll keep on going back to it because it's there's that bit. You remember that bit when everyone talks about this, like when Paul McCartney just starts writing Get Back, like, and there he is summoning this idea out of thin air. And we all know that's how songs get made. People, you know, you think of stuff and you try stuff and you try stuff until you find stuff that you like, and then you keep working on it till you like it more. But seeing that moment documented is just phenomenal, because no one's ever, it's really funny. It's like, what I love about that doc is that the Beatles were a band who were known for doing so many firsts and breaking new ground. There isn't a single band I can think of where that process of writing a record has been honestly and accurately captured on film. Because bands don't want cameras in the studio. Nobody wants a camera on them when they're writing a song. Like, fuck off, I'm trying to concentrate on writing this thing. Whereas they did it. Even to this day, that they're doing something, they're breaking new ground. So to see, and that's what it's like. Look, there's lots of people now know what it's like in the studio thanks to that film, because some of it is inspiration. Some of it is sitting around waiting for something to happen. Some of it is playing silly cover versions because you don't know what else to do. Other times it's just taking the piss out of the bass player. It's like, that's what it's like. That's why I love that film. Yeah. I think it's a wonderful depiction of four of the most charismatic people that ever lived. Once again, don't get me started, man. I'll keep going.
I found it fascinating that they realised that it'll be so important all these years later.
Yeah. I mean, they were fucking cool though, weren't they? Like, yeah, to understand that and know that. And also that it's so honest. I mean, obviously any film is edited, so there's always like, it's a person's interpretation of what happened. But apparently, and I know this from speaking to some of the people that worked on the film, playing name drop, I was like, oh, like how difficult was it after you'd finished it and you sent it away to Paul McCartney, you sent it to Ringo and you sent it to Yoko to all get their approval on it, to get them to sign off and say, okay, I'm happy with how I'm depicted and all this stuff. And the guy was like, oh, no, we just sent it to them. And there was like, they didn't really want any changes. They were like, yeah, that's it. Just put it out. Isn't that great? Like, to be so free of ego and so free of vanity that like, yep. Go on, that's fine. I might look like a bit of a knob in that scene, but that's what I was, a bit of a knob at that moment in time. Great, put it out. So wonderful.
Your rise to fame coincided with the changing musical landscape triggered by a revolution at Radio 1, which saw the station revert back to its original 17 to 25 demographic. How do you think Matthew Bannister's revolutionary shake-up of the network heralded the emergence of Britpop, What sort of prestige and status came with being amongst those bands who made up the new sound of Radio 1?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. It was enormously important. It was hugely important. You would get something that was kind of been the preserve of Steve Lamacq and Joe Wiley, lovely Joe, was kind of everywhere then. Like, all of a sudden, it made it democratic again. You know, I love the 80s, right? I was born in 1972, so I remember Live Aid and all that kind of stuff. And I like that idea of like, wow, look, here's your rock stars. They're up there. There's, you know, Freddie Mercury, and I love Queen. They're untouchable. They're different. This is Tears for Fears. They're like sort of almost pop gods.
Please excuse me for one moment. I just
please
charge it from the laptop. Continue.
Okay. Keep talking. But when the 90s came along, it was like, I'm seeing people and hearing people on the radio and think, well, I can do that. I look a bit like that. They've just started and they're getting some exposure. It felt like something that everybody could do. So when he did usher in this new era at Radio 1 and new bands were getting played, it felt so invigorating. It felt like you could do it too, because you could hear it on the radio. And so that legacy, but also the legacy of the fact that he had, from what I can tell, it was hugely unpopular at the time with the old school guys, and it was nearly all guys. In fact, almost, I think Radio 1 just was men. It wasn't, but it felt like it. He set the template for other radio bosses being able to do that in the future. You know, saying, look, no matter how established people are, no matter how, you know, respected these old DJs may be, you can get rid of them. It's okay. And you need to do that sometimes. And I think because Matthew Bannister did that, future controllers of radio stations have seen that as like, okay, he did that once. We can do it. If you want to mess things up, if you want to shake things up, if you want to get rid of old school presenters, then you can and you should, because the results can be overwhelmingly positive. So yes, it wasn't just what he did. It was weirdly that legacy, I think, was really important. You know, we definitely benefited from it hugely.
Part of this new shakeup meant that more incentive was given to shows like The Evening Session. In your opinion, how important was the show in giving a platform to the key figures in Britpop?
Oh, I mean, Steve and Joe, come on, to this day, they're still like hugely respected for their musical chops and their knowledge and their skills as broadcasters. I mean, they're both just awesome. And they changed the landscape of British music. There's a John Peel thing. So like a while ago, we did a 60 Music show from John Peel's house. It's a few years ago. So we kind of went there and got a chance to sort of see his record collection, which is vast, and talk to people that he'd worked with and stuff, which is obviously a real honour. And in many ways, because of the impact he had, because of what John Peel played, the exposure it got and how respected he was and how he championed things, part of Britain's musical taste, part of what we like and how we think about music, is down to John Peel. Like he's that important. And yeah. I think Steve and Joe did that as well. I think such was their influence and such was their good taste that they've kind of, are they the musical conscience of the nation? Maybe that's it. And there'll always be people coming through, and there always has been before, and there always will be in the future. But definitely John Peel and definitely Steve and Joe, they're kind of like, they're sort of on your shoulder helping you out. And they've changed, you know, like, look at festival lineups. Festival lineups are a certain way because we as a country think about music in a certain way and we like certain things and we don't really like blandness. We like humour. We like the odd abrasive thing just because it shakes us up a little bit. We like, you know, and that's down to these key people, isn't it? And Steve and Joe are definitely one of those. I mean, they helped Menswear enormously. I mean, professionally, they've been brilliant to me in what I do as a radio broadcaster and a presenter. They've always been hugely helpful and supportive to loads of things that I've done in the past. And they're just lovely people. And Steve, especially, has still got, people still will come up to him with CDs, like on the street, you know, to this day, I don't know how many times a day. Mm-hmm. And he still listens to them. The amount of time he devotes to literally sitting in his room, tape, CD, stream, tape, stream, tape, record, disc, vinyl, all the time for hours and hours and hours, because he is absolutely driven by the fear that, like, or maybe I'll miss out on that thing that could be just them. That next demo could be phenomenal. And I want people to hear it. You know, yeah, they're dudes. Love them.
And they're both so
humble. Yeah, and they're both so humble.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's, yeah, they're like, yeah, if they were American jocks with that, like, parent status, they wouldn't be fucking hanging out with me, you know? Like, come on. They're like, yeah, they're just nice people as well, you know?
Yeah, when Josh interviewed Joe Wiley a little while ago, she said she just didn't like talking about herself.
There you go, you see. Yeah. Yeah. She's like, she said very nice things about you as well. She's good people, man. It's lovely.
So you joined the Montrose Avenue in 1996 at the height of Britpop. How did your experience with menswear help you to navigate the hurdles of the industry at that time? And what were the main differences between the experiences you had in both of those bands?
Well, I mean, I wish I could say that menswear taught me a lot. I think it did in hindsight. I think now, or like many years later, I've got a better understanding of people and how bands work. The industry worked to an extent. I really loved Montrose Avenue. I still do. I think they're a really, really, really brilliant band. And I love the fact that they had me in the group, because I had a certain amount of baggage as being in a band that turned into a little bit of a sort of byword for the worst of Britpop. And we were really good. I really enjoyed the music we did. We got it up on Spotify last year, and we did a reissue of the record. And it was really nice to hear it again. I think the guys, amazing singers. But very much out of their time. Nobody was really into Crosby, Stills and Nash and Young and West Coast Harmonies in 1996, 1997. Nobody really cared. But that was the cool thing about it. I'm very, very, very proud of that group. Very proud to be in them. And I know that, you know, from a self-centered point of view, that's some of the best playing I ever did. Some of the best sort of music I ever played, and my own personal playing. I played good with them. But the industry was still pretty mercenary. Like, and as Britpop started to kind of go south, you know, these big record companies were awash with cash, but very mercenary about, like, how they treated artists. You know, there was a point in the height of Britpop when pretty much anyone could get signed, pretty much anyone could make money. Like, your singles would fly out the shops, you'd make money from singles. That doesn't happen anymore. You make money from record sales. That doesn't happen anymore. You make a lot of money from touring. That doesn't really happen anymore. Record companies would get a return on their investment pretty quickly, but most bands take a while to get going. And Montrose had one album. It sold like 30,000, which is a lot in these days. But we never got a chance to do the second record, because it's like, well, they haven't made any money. They're not huge. Fuck them off. Sack them off. And so we kind of got dropped. And so, which is a shame, because I think there was a lot of potential with that group. But I'm sure loads of people could say that about the bands. You always love the bands you're in most of the time. So, yeah, it was a hard thing to deal with, having a second chance and then it going tits up. That wasn't great. But, you know, how fortunate was I to get to do it even once, to do it at all?
In your opinion, was that the end of Britpop?
Well, I mean, there's a story that I tell when I get asked about the end of Britpop, and I don't think it's the truth, but it's a good story. But I'll do the story before what I think the truth is. We were in San Francisco. I think it was towards the end of the band, so like very start of 96 or something. And for some reason, lots of Britpop bands, tours, all crisscrossed and coincided to be in the same spot in San Francisco at the same time. Blur were there playing a big show. Supergrass were there. Charlatans were there. Gene were there. Another band as well. And us all in this same hotel. I remember thinking, and everybody, I'm sure there's exceptions because there's some good people, everyone was just acting like a really arrogant arsehole. Everyone was drunk. Everyone was high on their own success, even though that success in America was minor, more in Blur's case. You know, I remember with hindsight thinking, God, that was like, why are you all acting like you've won? This is the start now. This is your first step into America. And everyone was acting like such a bunch of cliched wannabe rock stars and just thinking, Charlatans weren't, because they've been around for a while. I remember them being, their heads were screwed on a bit more. So everyone acting like ourselves. That's my recollection, just thinking, everyone's going to fuck this up. Everyone's too full of themselves. Everyone's going to fuck it up. This can't carry on. And I was wrong. Lots of bands went on to do amazing work. We didn't. But I know that everybody had like a dark tea time of the soul. There's, you know, everyone had a hard time post their big fame. Obviously, Blur went through a lot and Pulp went through a lot. Charlatans, there was some bereavement. They lost members and that was hard for them. Usually hard. So, and, you know, even Supergrass found it difficult and Gene didn't really make it. So there's, yeah. But was that the end of it? I don't know what the end of it was. I'm not sure. I actually, you know what? For me, it was. There you go. There was a point when the Stone Roses played Reading Festival and they headlined Reading. And Rennie had gone, I think John Squire had gone, it was only two of them, and they were awful. They were supposed to be, it was the big coming, the godfather, one of the godfathers of Britpop, headlining Reading Festival. This is it, they're back. Okay, a couple of guys are gone. See, never take the drummer out of the equation. The minute Rennie went out the Stone Roses, never as good. Just not. And they were so bad that people just started to walk away, and Underworld were playing on a different tent on the other side of the festival. Underworld were kind of obviously had a bit of success. But here we started hearing Underworld and they started playing Born Slippy, which had obviously been a big hit. And everyone just, there was an exodus of people going, oh, this is done. It's over, this band here. It's bloated. They got like go-go dancers on stage, I think. It's probably not true. Just thinking, what the fuck is this? And everyone just rushing over to go and watch Underworld and thinking, this is more exciting. This is more real. This is more current. This isn't, yeah. And that's when, like, do we want more Britpop bands? No, we don't. Maybe that's my answer.
So joining Six Music as a presenter, how do you think your musical journey helped to cultivate your broadcasting style?
Have I got a broadcasting style?
You tell us.
The best thing, what helped me be, the thing I'm most proud of is interviewing musicians. It's what I love doing. That's the thing. That's what I'm good at doing. And I think that's because I was a musician. I think a lot of it is skill and techniques. And you know, you interview people, like you prepping your questions and thinking in that way. But it gave me an empathy and an understanding of what it's like to be at a crappy service station at 2 o'clock in the morning. Even if you're fucking David Bowie. Even if you're David Bowie, at some point you've been like at a shit, like truck stop in Hamburg or like outside some freezing cold town in Montreal. And you're going, I just want a sandwich and I can't. It's shit. Everyone's been through that. And that and lots of other things means when I interview musicians, I have that understanding. And with some exceptions, I don't get impressed by people. I get really impressed by their work. And there's exceptions, like I shit my pants every time I speak to Paul McCartney, clearly. But like, I think if you've done the work, once again, you'll know, if you've done the work, it's not scary. It's not, wow, here comes the big star. It's like, yeah, I'm looking forward to speaking to this person. It's going to be interesting. They're going to have interesting things to say. And that comes from, I think, being around music and musicians and knowing that they're just people. they like to be treated a certain way, the big stars, so it's understanding that as well. So I think that's what it gave me, you know, some kind of empathy. And you know some of those people, which is nice as well.
And just following on from that, having seen people like John Peel, Chris Evans and Joe Wiley in full command of a radio show back in the day, how did this offer you an unconscious insight into what you would become?
I mean, those are all people that can really run a radio show. Most of my radio shows were done with Sean Keaveney, and a masterful control of the radio was not something that me and Sean attempted to do. Well, actually, I mean, let's say that. That's as a joke. It's unfair. Sean is a brilliant, brilliant broadcaster. And makes it look really, really easy and makes the funny stuff sound like it's just kind of happened. And it's very, very difficult. Sean's a brilliant broadcaster. I don't know. I always thought I never set out to be on radio, but then I remember when I was a little kid, I used to record radio shows into a cassette player when I was probably about, I don't know,
yeah,
or something. And I hadn't thought about that for years. So maybe I always wanted to do it. I don't really like the sound of my own voice, which is odd because I like talking. I don't know. I've been really, really fortunate that I guess I've just pursued things that I've wanted to do and make me happy and I get something out of. I really, really enjoy interviewing people. Yeah. I get a bit uncomfortable being interviewed, but I really, really, really like to speak to musicians because I like to find out. I think that it's important. I think that music's really, really important. I think, you know, obviously for some people it's canoeing or gardening or whatever, that it's their thing. But for me, I think is it the great art form? I guess for me it is. And so to speak to people about how they work and what they're thinking about and get into that, it's fascinating. So to be able to do that for a living, it's fucking great, you know. So maybe I unconsciously pursued it. But I never planned on ending up here, really.
Your podcast, The First Time, gives significant figures in music the opportunity to reflect on the seminal moments that have defined their careers. Looking at these interviews as a whole, what do they say about the ever-changing musical landscape?
Oh, good question. Again, we've done about 250 first times now. It's been a lot. We've done a lot of people. What have we learnt? You know, what's weird is, and this comes out, the very, very, very first influences, the really, really super early stuff is the stuff that sticks and you hear it later. I was one of Pink Floyd, name check again, it could even have been David Gilmour, one of the Pink Floyd guys. And they were like, I said, the first thing I remember was my parents used to play this really weird experimental jazz music. And then also big, long, emotional classical things. I'm going, that's it. There you go. That's it. That's what you became. It was there straight away. Strange, weird, experimental stuff and beautiful, beautiful sort of cosmic. Those things. Often the first real things that hit people are who they end up being. Often. I mean, there's obviously people that change that, but the first punk band that Dave Grohl was taken to by his sister in Washington when he was I talked about Dave Grohl a lot, when he was 14. No matter all the other amazing stuff he does and has done, part of him just wants to be in a punk band and feel like he did when he was 14, taken to a underground gig with his sister. That's going to be at the very center of his DNA. You know, look at Coldplay, those really beautiful, very fragile early songs that Chris Martin wrote, straight from just there. No matter how big a stadium they get and how amazing they are at connecting with all those tens of thousands of people with huge broad strokes of colour and sound, really what he wants to do with those songs is just be that one guy. Not one guy, but be that person connecting that feeling from him to one person. That's always at the bottom. And I think that's always there, the early thing. Yeah, I think that's the one unifying thing. Also, musicians tend to be the unifying thing, are pretty nice. I think there's this idea that often musicians, especially big stars or difficult musicians, quote unquote difficult musicians, are kind of somehow, or they're unapproachable, or you can't talk to them, or they haven't got a sense of humor, and they're not. I think probably coming back to that, you've spent a bunch of time in a transit van eating Ginster's pasties. even if you're Kate Bush or Prince. Maybe not Prince. Maybe Prince never had Ginsters pasties. But, like, there is a universality to the experience of being a working musician that everyone has, which means generally under it all, you're a pretty decent person. You like what you do. You express yourself for a living. You know, I've never really had... I've interviewed some assholes, but not on the first time. I've never come across anyone that I've been like, oh, they were a dick. Yeah. You know, she was fucking awful. It's never happened. They've all been... Some take a bit more time to get through to, but they've all been nice. But I'm quite optimistic about that. I think, you know, there's a lot of assholes seemingly in the government at the moment, but generally I think people are pretty nice, have the potential to be good to each other.
So who's been the one person that really made you shit yourself when you...
I got that question. I did an interview with Ringo Starr, one of the first big interviews I ever did, and I love Ringo, as you can tell. And halfway through the interview, my brain just went, "Doy." And I couldn't get a question out. I couldn't ask him a question. And I had worked for days on these questions. I had them in front of me. I knew the order. I was ready to respond to different things he might have said. And I put the difficult question next to it. And I just went, I couldn't do it. I just said something. I don't know. And he just leant forward and he put his hand on my knee and just went, "Ask me a question, anything you want, and I'll answer it." I was like, oh, thank you. Such a lovely thing to say to someone that was clearly like having a complete freak out, from someone that's been interviewed every day of his life, probably since he was about 18. I thought it was really lovely and a lovely, warm, generous thing to do. I remember that being, yeah, just wanting to get it right so badly that I couldn't ask a question. And I did an interview with Nick Cave that was so bad, we never put the interview out. Because it was like, he was doing Grindr Man. That album did. And this is all on me. I hadn't done my research. I hadn't listened to the record. I'd listened to it a little bit, but not properly. I hadn't thought about my questions because obviously I was probably feeling a bit cocky that I'd just come off the back of a couple of good interviews. Oh, I can do this. And sat down with him and it was like a shark in the water. He could tell that I hadn't prepared properly and he could tell that I wasn't ready and that my questions weren't properly thought out. And he just, he didn't tear me to pieces. He was just like, "What are we doing this for? Why are we here?" And I like, don't know. Oh, it's a shame because he started doing interviews again now for a long time. He just didn't do interviews. Hopefully not because of me. he stopped. But there's an addendum to this. He did, because he stopped doing interviews, but he was doing these big tours where he'd perform to an audience and then take questions from the audience. Really lovely thing to do. Cause he was like, "I don't want to speak to journalists. I speak to people that in the audience." And he was taking questions from the audience. And I really want to ask a question. And he'd mentioned this thing about, when he wakes up in the morning, he at 9 o'clock, that's when I start writing, you know, I do it very, he said, I remember this. He said, "I get dressed to start work." And I thought, I had this really good question. I was like, because it's like, that's what the Stax musicians and the Motown musicians used to do. They used to kind of turn up at the studio, suit, tie, ready for work, clock in at 9, get the job done. None of this like, yeah, the magic happens at 2 in the morning. No, you go to work, get dressed for it, do the job. That's your job. You're a professional. And I had this idea of like, oh, I can ask Nick about this idea of kind of getting dressed for work and how that changes his mindset. And it sort of came out really, I put my hand up and he picked me and it came out really badly. And it says, could you wear anything to when you write? So it was just a complete car crash question. I just got it all fucked up. He was like, "What do you fucking mean? I'm not going to work in my fucking pajamas." And this is to an audience of like 1,000 people. It was like, "Oh, I've done it again. I fucked it up again." So yeah, he might be the only person I'm too scared to interview now. Just because of that experience.
That's
Oh, yeah, Josh had a moment like that with Tim Brooke Taylor a couple of years ago.
Just right.
You asked him a question, didn't you? It was a question that Josh devised, and you're really proud of it. And it's a similar question you asked Barry Cry a few years previous. It was about the Frost Report.
Yeah.
He posed it to Tim Brooke Taylor. He had no idea. He completely, like, just froze on the spot. He didn't understand it. It was a very awkward few minutes, wasn't it?
It's part of what we do as interviewers is every so often you've just got to get like absolutely kicked in the ass by someone intentionally or not to just go, okay, this does happen. Yeah. But it's awful. It's awful. I did an interview, Mark Lanigan, who's now died. I wanted to do an interview with him I was on a radio station called XFM that's now called Radio X in London. And it was a phone interview. It had taken ages to get an interview. And he was a heroin addict, which doesn't really help any potential interview. Notoriously difficult, terse, grumpy old fucker. Great musician. And I remember this was the worst interview I ever did. And I was talking to him down the phone. And his answers were getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter until eventually the answers were just like one word. And I'd say, oh, so like, you know, the sessions that you did, you know, apparently they weren't even supposed to come out. And when did you decide, you know, was it quite close to the album coming out? You decided to release them? No. Okay, so, and the band that you put together, was that always going to be the band that it? No. So you're coming over to the UK. Is it something you're looking forward to? You know, we've always appreciated your music here. No. And I asked another question and there was just no answer. I was like, oh, the producer that you work with, are you going to be working with again? Nothing. And I asked another question. Oh, so is the plan still to do Reading? Nothing at all. Silence on the end of the phone. And I said, is anyone there? And a voice just went, no. And I was like, okay, thank you very much for your time. Donk, and that was it. So, which is a good story, but not a good interview. Bless him. Bless his crazy heroin cotton socks. Poor chap.
So if you had to pinpoint a specific moment that defined Britpop, what would it be? And also, what's the legacy of Britpop?
Glastonbury, the Britpop Glastonbury. If there was a defining moment, it was when the Stone Roses, them again, pulled out and Pulp played. That whole weekend was brilliant. I mean, I remember it being brilliant because it was the first time that I'd ever played Glastonbury. And I remember stepping out of the tour bus onto the grass and the weather was glorious, just thinking, this is us, our gang, all our bands and contemporaries, we were all here performing. And the audience felt made up a lot of people that really loved that kind of music. It was not the shifting of the guard, because Glastonbury is always going to be connected to the kind of the cosmic stuff. But it felt like a new, younger audience were at Glastonbury to see these bands, and that moment felt brilliant. And then Pulp were transcendently good. That moment of a band stepping up to play better than they ever thought they could play, having exactly those songs, having the right songs for the right moment. And you watch the footage now, it's funny when you watch sort of Glastonbury these days, like everyone's got fucking loads of screens and light and this huge and big production. They were just kind of two screens and some ordinary light, same as Radiohead. But they still, it's still the most phenomenal performance. That was the moment for me. That was the absolute pinnacle. You know, we've won. Jarvis is a national pop star. You know, strange, odd, eccentric, lanky, odd-looking Jarvis is a pop star. We've done it. The misfits have won. The weird ones, the ones who were made to feel strange at the school discos because we weren't dancing to Bananarama, we've won. You know, the kids with odd eye makeup and the people that didn't feel like they could do sports or like didn't have cool cars because they'd spent their money on guitars instead. We've won. We've done it. That was just amazing. It still feels kind of cool. You know, that was lovely. It's legacy. I mean, the '90s is like, retro, which is kind of weird, freaks me out. I'm 51 now and it still feels odd that 1995 was that long ago. And now you can get like 90s fancy dress costumes. That's very weird for someone my age. I cannot tell you how odd it is to see like 18 year olds in like bucket hats. And you're like, what the fuck? Like, but I guess, you know, when I started wearing bootcut jeans, my parents must have been like, it's not the '70s, get over it. So it's the circle of life. Hakuna Matata. So the legacy, I'd like to think that thing I said again about like 80s stars being like, wow, they're up there on a pedestal. You're never going to be, you know, Elton John. You're never going to be Freddie Mercury. But you could be, you know, Liam, or you could be Damon. You work very hard. You could be those people. If you could be Jarvis. You could be Gaz. There were kids like you. You could do that. And that, I think, that pervades. And also this idea that, like, indie means something, you know? It's like there's that spirit. There is an alternative. No matter what's on telly, no matter what's selling in bucket loads, if it's awful, there is an alternative. Sometimes the two things coexist and all of a sudden, like, a really amazing band is selling these records and it becomes an event. But there's always an alternative, and that's yours if you'd like to investigate it. And it will take you down all these amazing routes into the past. You know, if you get into Arctic Monkeys, you get into Scott Walker. Wow, okay, it's the whole world. You know, if you get into Radiohead, then you're going to get into, you know, The Fall and New Order. And there's all these lovely routes that go backwards and always will. And every new band is their own little layer of sediment on top of that. You know, that's kind of brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
So looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
My proudest achievement of my career? Still fucking here, I guess. That's kind of all right. Kate Bush, probably. I did an interview with Kate Bush, who doesn't often do many interviews, very rarely. And it was one of my good ones. And I love that interview. It was really good. I think she really got off on it. I think I brought something out of her that maybe some other people hadn't been able to do. Very proud of that chap. Very proud. Anytime I do anyone that's got that kind of weight behind them, you know, Mavis Staples or one of the fucking Beatles or Smokey Robinson, you're like, Jesus Christ. I don't know what, like, I've done whatever the path has been to take me this far. I'm trusted enough or known as doing what I do sufficiently well enough to put me in a room with those people. And that's, I'm really, really pleased I've had those opportunities. That makes me feel kind of proud. And I'm still fucking here. You know, it's all right, isn't it?
When you
said you interviewed Kate Bush, someone like her who doesn't interview very often, was it hard for you to do your prep and your like research into that? Did you find it difficult?
I mean, yeah. I mean, once again, this is something that you do. You do your prep. You do the work. you know, you work really, really hard at getting the questions right, getting them in the right order, doing the research. You kind of arm up, don't you? You know, you're like, you can anticipate what might happen and be ready for those things happen. She could be on a good day, she could be a bad day, she might react wrongly to that question. You've got to have the question that's going to follow up the question that goes wrongly, or if it goes really, really well, what's the question you move to that point? You know, all these things, you do the work so when it happens, you're not underprepared. And I joke about it a lot, obviously, you know, it's just fucking great to meet these people, but there's when it's somebody like that, you take it really, really seriously, but don't seem like you're taking it seriously. If you go into it and she's like, oh, he looks like he's about to go to war, it's going to be a fucking terrible interview. So you kind of like, that's part of it as well, is being relaxed, being low key, having a cup of tea and a piece of cake when they walk in and just making it quite nice. While internally, you're absolutely, the wheels are whirring to get ready for whatever they say and how to react. And can I take the piss a little bit? Should I not? Should I reference this thing? Should I not? She's not going to want to say that. But if I ask her about that, then it's all, the cogs are going really fast. I guess that's what I enjoy about doing the first time, is like you get people when you have to be like that. And if you're not like that, you won't get the best out of the interview. And then you're a dick for wasting the opportunity. And people are going to hate you for doing a bad job. You know, you don't want fucking Kate Bush fans, like people being like, oh my God, you've got an hour with Kate Bush. And you asked her about like a favorite, like in colour pencil. But you know what I mean? Like, you know, I mean, I did an interview with Paul McCartney, which is just an amazing thing to be able to say. And my wife, Beth, kind of came along for part of it because she's a big fan and held it together for the whole thing. And I was prepped and ready and da 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 da. And as we were leaving, out of shot of Paul McCartney, we both burst into tears because it was like, that just happened. We just did that. That was such a fucking honor. And he was so great. And the relief of it going, right. And we both like, I'm actually feeling quite emotional about it now. Yeah, we need to go for a big gin and tonic. Because that was such a thing to be able to do. And it's a kind of honor as well. But yeah, like when it's done, boom, the walls kind of come crashing down a bit and you burst into tears sometimes. But if you didn't feel like that, then why are you doing it? You know, if it didn't mean that much, then you're in the wrong fucking job, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, Josh did that recently when he had the opportunity to meet Sir Michael Parkinson.
Fuck off! Yeah. Oh my God, what happened?
And then said, you know,
Josh went to the Hay Festival and Sir Michael Parkinson was doing like a talk there, and Josh queued up afterwards, and whilst they're in the queue they were told that no photos could be taken, but eventually you got to the front, and Sir Michael's son actually noticed Josh and recognised him and said, he's not a member of the public. he managed to get a few pictures with him.
Amazing. Was he really, really lovely? Was he sound?
He actually said, I know who you are.
Fuck off. Oh my God. Right, yeah, that makes my name drops look pretty lame. Good work. Bloody hell.
Yeah. Well, just to finish off, what's next for Matt Everett?
What's next for me? I'm going to have a cup of tea. I'm going to go for a little walk. I've got a company and we make podcasts and we make documentaries and stuff. So we are working on, there's a series and a podcast series we did all about Joy Division and New Order. We did the first season a few years ago. So the next season is in production at the moment. So we've got all the band talking about their career. So that's being made at the moment. That's pretty exciting. We just finished a series, an audio series about Kylie Minogue for BBC, BBC Sounds. So there's some more stuff. There's a really interesting podcast. I can't talk about it yet. It's going to be coming out before the end of the year for the BBC with a really, really big band. So we're working on that. And yeah, like trying to find interesting shows to make and trying not to work too hard. And yeah, keep and another series of The First Time soon, hopefully, which will be good. I'm not quite sure when that's going to be on air, but that's going to be happening before the end of the year. And yeah, just keep trying to do it. Keep trying to do interesting things. Keep trying to, yeah, do things that interest me. Speak to musicians. Tell good stories.
Thank you, and that's a great way to end.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to our guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else that takes your fancy? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music, and Amazon Music. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews. And if you love Josh, please give us a little share. And we don't mean the Shoop Shoop song. Thanks again, and hopefully see you next time.